I'm upset. There have been so many problems, so many challenges in the Jewish world this past year that we, I know I can speak for my colleagues, at least we, the clergy, have not been able to keep up. Many of these incidents have been in or involved Israel, but not exclusively. The general consensus in the Jewish world says that we are at a historic low point, a breaking point, actually, in the relationship between Israel and the American diaspora. I'm worried because there is a chasm dividing the Jewish world today, but I don't think it's really about Israel. I believe that we have in the Jewish world two main schools of thought, deeply in disagreement with each other. Two schools of thought on what it means to be Jewish, on the priorities for our community and its resources. Two schools of thought on our place and purpose in the world as Jews. Israel is often the focal point around which these two sides clash, and American Jews are often the loudest critics. So in tribute to the division in ancient days between the two Talmuds, I'll call the first school the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem school. And an acknowledgement of an insert we sometimes find today in Oseh Shalom, I'll call the other school the school of Yoshevei Tevel, the school of those who dwell on earth. The differences between them are not primarily about Israel. The two sides, I don't think, differ much on questions like the right to a Jewish homeland or the classical issues of Zionism. Most Jews of the Yoshevei Tevel school, I would say, are Zionists in a way that Herzl, Brandeis, and the founding Zionist leaders of 100 years ago would recognize. We differ over the meaning of Jewish identity and Jewish community, however. Our differences are most evident over two major issues: the Holocaust and assimilation, or to be more specific, about how we respond to modernity. One of the greatest problems from the past year, highlighting this divide, is Gaza. You might recall from the spring and summer, over 60 people were killed and 1,000 were shot and wounded by Israeli troops during 6 weeks of protests at the Gaza border fence, culminating on May 14th, but continuing afterwards even a bit to this day. The incident produced a bitter clash between Jews defending Israel and Jews criticizing Israel, but they tended to shout past one another because they think they're debating Zionist issues. They think they're debating about Israel, but they're not. The question that really remained unanswered, undebated even, was not whether Israeli troops were right or wrong, ethical or inappropriate when they responded with such force. It was not whether Palestinian terrorists had manipulated the situation. The question that remained unanswered, even unasked, was how did so many Jews rise up to defend the shooting of so many people on a single day, to make that one of their most public statements of Jewish identity of the year? And the answer, I think, is the Holocaust. When we debate each other over the morality of using force in Gaza, we are debating the lessons of the Holocaust. How you understand the Holocaust and what lessons we must learn from it inform some of the most important decisions we make about how we interact in the world with fellow Jews and what actions one thinks are reasonable in the face of a threat. When we believe that the Holocaust is a unique event in human history, when we believe that Jews were the victims of something that no one else had ever faced, that nobody who had the power to save us did so, and that anti-Semitism, the ancient hatred which fueled the Holocaust, is still alive today, when we believe those things, we can then give ourselves permission to do anything we need, by any means necessary, if you'll allow me to borrow that quote, against any perceived threat. So, according to that school of thought, because Palestinian leaders continue to speak like anti-Semites, even if they also speak like peacemakers. And because Palestinian organizations and individuals have, throughout the past decades, hurt and killed Jews for being Jews, and because some of those organizations and people were clearly involved in the Gaza protests, then the occupation, the killing, and the second-class status of Palestinians is not unreasonable. It's not even bad. Now, if we understand the Holocaust to be one manifestation of that, quote, problem from hell, the hundreds of genocides throughout history, if our experience, while tragic and personally most important to us, is not really different from the experience of Armenia, Rwanda, Bosnia, or Cambodia, then we have no moral higher ground and no special position from which we can do anything different than other countries or other peoples in the name of self-defense. Indeed, if we are a shining example of how a people can rise from the ashes of genocide to create the, quote, startup nation, then our lesson should be to help all humanity and use our tenacity, our genius, and our rich cultural heritage to stop genocide, stop oppression anywhere against anybody, and foster freedom and human betterment for everyone, including Palestinians. Now, what makes me think that the Gaza and other debates are really about the Holocaust when no one is really mentioning it? I had a friend in a previous congregation, typical, I think, of some people, a politically conservative older guy who, when he got frustrated with our political discussions about things like Gaza and the Palestinians, would say, "You liberal Jews would have missed the last train out of Poland." Now, he also used to say that he was a one-issue voter. The only thing that mattered in the ballot box to him was Israel. I came to learn, however, that this person didn't actually understand himself. He was a one-issue voter, but the only thing that really mattered to him, his only worry, was that last train out and making sure it would never happen, even if it meant blowing up all tracks before the trains could be put on them. We hear a similar refrain from public leaders like David Friedman, the current U.S. ambassador to Israel. His infamous critique of J Street and its supporters is that they are, quote, worse than capos. Capos were Jewish prisoners in concentration camps who were used by the SS to keep control over fellow Jews and to actually aid the Nazis in their work. It's a telling smear. In the middle of debating Gaza or the two-state solution or Iran or whatever policy, they don't call us stupid or ill-informed or just wrong. They go to a particular type of Holocaust imagery. Sheep led to the slaughter. Or worse, Jews complicit in the torture and destruction of their own people. Folks like Friedman don't just have a policy difference that upsets them. They believe we have not learned the lessons of the Holocaust, and we represent an internal threat, which is even worse than an external threat. Now, this critique is actually embodied in the design of Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Museum. Its exhibit starts with a movie shown on a constant loop, actual footage and images of Jews from pre-war Europe living their daily lives at parties, outdoors, ice skating, at schools. The movie is projected onto the first wall of the museum building, which you can see from the outside is actually a free-floating extension of the building, hanging off its foundation the way, say, the side or the front of this podium does. So to go inside, then, and watch the movie is to see Jewish life without any real base. As happy as it looks, and as happy as it probably felt to the people themselves, the design says something very significant. We know how the story ends, so it's heartbreaking to actually watch. These Jews are literally missing the last train out of Poland, and they're laughing. They are dancing over a cliff into the pit. Now, this stands in stark contrast to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. In the spring, Our clergy and some staff went to the museum during Yom HaShoah week. We participate in the continuous reading of victims' names in the museum's Remembrance Hall. This year, for various reasons, was particularly moving. After we read the names, we offered a memorial prayer together in the hall, and then together visited the current exhibition in the museum's Simon Scotes Center for the Prevention of Genocide. It's an exhibit called Syria, Please Do Not Forget Us. And it's a major effort by the museum, in their own words, quote, to sound the alarm for policymakers and the public about atrocities being committed by the Assad regime, end quote. It features the story of a man named Mansour Omari who survived imprisonment and torture and smuggled out evidence of those crimes, which are on display in the exhibit in the Holocaust Museum, including five scraps of fabric on which Mansour and his fellow prisoners wrote their names in an ink that they made out of rust and their own blood, agreeing that whoever got out first would take those strips of cloth, take the list so he could inform his cellmates' families about what had happened to them. It's incredibly powerful, and it's no coincidence where that exhibit sits. Our museum's design also conveys an important statement about what we should learn from the Holocaust. The Syria exhibit and the Center for Genocide Prevention is the first thing you encounter when you leave the main exhibition. The resolution to the story of the Holocaust, it's no coincidence, it's the Genocide Prevention Center. It's also no coincidence that you enter the museum from its outside on 15th Street under a quote from General Eisenhower, the leader of the liberating army, inscribed on the wall of the Hall of Remembrance. For this school of thought, the most important lesson of the Holocaust is our responsibility as humans to stop genocide and the murder of innocent people anywhere, even strangers from countries halfway across the world, people with whom we have no connection. Now, the Israelis know exactly what we stand for and what we believe in. Sometimes they need us. This past winter, the embassy called and asked if we would host a special visitor that they were bringing to the States, the spiritual leader of the Druze, Sheikh Moafak Tarif. He came to Temple Sinai. Some of you probably heard him. He had an entourage of Druze diplomats and politicians with him. The night was a classic example of what we value. Interfaith worship with a sheikh in his flowing robes, Israeli embassy staff, a beautiful musical service with Neil on the piano, our clergy team, followed by a dinner with a cadre of temple members, catered by a company called Foodini that provides catering from refugee chefs who've recently arrived. The dinner had been prepared by a newly arrived Syrian refugee. The sheikh presented me with a gift of traditional Druze prayer beads, and I gave him a challah cover that had been embroidered by hand with the words Shabbat Shalom from a group of Central American immigrant women at a community center in South Texas where we had volunteered a year earlier. All of those pieces in place was almost ridiculous. It was almost like a caricature of American progressive Judaism to the extreme. Except it really was no joke. It was such a beautifully true picture of who we are and what we believe is most important to us. So when the nation state law was passed in Israel over the summer, those who followed the Jerusalem School of Jewish Identity swelled with pride at how clearly it elevated the importance of Jewishness over anything else. Now that seems like something all Jews could agree with, the importance of Jewishness. But again, Jews began fighting with over Jews over the propriety of that law and the ways it denigrated others and their culture as much as it elevated ours. And we saw then how differently from them we think about our Judaism and our relationship with other people when suddenly our obscure winter Shabbos guest was the face of the protest. Sheikh Tarif, and the members of the Druze community, along with many Israelis, Jewish and not, had taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and across Israel to protest the limiting chauvinism of the law. And that's when I felt the swelling pride, because it brought back a memory from his visit. The Sheikh had told me at dinner that even though he is a religious and public leader, in the heart of the Jewish state, he had never before been invited to a Shabbat dinner or a Shabbat service. That's who we are. Much ink has been spilled on Prime Minister Netanyahu and why he would embrace so many policies, so many decisions, like that nation-state law, that seemed designed to create distance between Israel and the American Jewish community. There is no doubt politics at work. But more than anything, Benjamin Netanyahu is a leading proponent of that Jerusalem school of Jewish identity. And that is the primary place from which I think he operates. He sees himself not just as a politician, not just as the leader of a nation. At the Paris memorial service following Charlie Hebdo and the kosher market attack, he portrayed himself in a speech as the leader of the Jews who had come to save the Jews and bring them back to Israel. He stood in a synagogue, not in the halls of government, not in the public square, and not just as the leader of a nation standing with its ally, but as a man protecting Jewish identity. An incident from October 1997 is worth revisiting because it captures the essence of the disagreement between these two schools, and it foretold this summer's breaking point. Netanyahu, newly serving then as prime minister, visited the sukkah of a religious leader, Rabbi Yitzhak Kaduri, to celebrate their birthdays, which fell on the same date. Netanyahu was turning 48, Rabbi Kaduri, 100. Not realizing that an Israel radio mic was recording him, Netanyahu leaned over to the rabbi and said, "The left has forgotten what it means to be Jewish." There was an uproar, especially from the opposition. And Yossi Sarid, then leader of the left-wing Meretz Party, responded publicly, "Netanyahu has forgotten what it means to be a human being." This echoes a famous line from Yehuda Gordon Leib's poetry from the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment of the 19th century. He wrote this phrase that became a slogan: "Be a human on the streets and a Jew in your own house." Now, fast forward to this summer, and we find that same dynamic at work. The Israeli government and leaders of world Jewish organizations, including the URJ, were locked in a battle over an egalitarian prayer space near the Kotel, the Western Wall. The government had actually built a temporary area for that use, and the Knesset was debating its expansion and funds to make it permanent. Miri Regev, the Knesset member charged with overseeing that process, resigned her committee chair position, saying she simply could not in good faith be part of such a horrible thing. She said, to be fair, she had met Reform Jews when she was in Argentina, and they were nice people. But they should stay in Argentina where they could act like Argentinians, while in Israel, they would act like Israelis. Another MK from the Shas party suggested that American Jews should take all the money they spend in Israel, keep it, and build themselves their own kotel in the States. Now, we've heard these kinds of insults for years. Reform Jews, conservative Jews, they aren't real Jews. And they don't just come from Orthodox leaders. They come from non-religious leaders, too. Miri Regev is not a religious leader. I heard it and couldn't help think, how dare you? We're not Jewish. You're not Jewish. Why is it that we always receive the critique but never give it? Why is it that we don't actually act on the suggestions of people like that Shas MK? Now, I'm not talking about taking our toys and stomping off in a temper tantrum, some tit-for-tat reaction. I'm talking about actually standing strong and acting on what we believe it means to be Jewish in 5779. These leaders are not just drawing lines about political policy. They're drawing lines about Jewish practice and Jewish identity, and we can't accept their definition. I spoke with a temple member named Johanna Siegel right after Rosh Hashanah. She grew up at Sinai. She's now a junior in college. She attended the Erev Rosh Hashanah festivities at her school with a few friends. Co-sponsored by Hillel and Chabad, they call it their annual Unity Rosh Hashanah service. And they seem very proud of this wonderful display of Jewish solidarity, of the principle from the Talmud, the Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, all Israel responsible for each other. Unity on such an important holiday, hooray, right? After the pre-service social gathering, she and her friend, another woman who had grown up in Nifty with her here in the area, they headed to the service and walked into a machitza divided room. Which is to say, a room with a divider, a separator for a men's area and a women's area. That prayer would be done according to the traditional Jewish laws of modesty. She was caught totally by surprise. This was the campus service for everyone, the big unity service. But in this partnership, their principle was to defer to the, quote, highest level of observance, which meant the level of observance that doesn't allow men and women to mix. Seems like a small thing, though, right? Easy enough to go along and get along. It's the new year. It's a Jewish value. It's their big shindig. She should just go in, right? Except actually, it's not. By doing that, we would compromise everything that we hold to be fundamental and dear. We have not forgotten what it means to be Jewish, and we no longer accept Gordon's 19th century division of ourselves to be Jewish in one place and human in another. Our school of thought holds them together inseparably. To be Jewish must be informed by our connection to Yoshevei Tevel, to all of humanity. That service with the Sheikh actually is our model. This service tonight, an even better or equal example, we have men and women sitting together, praying together. We have musical instruments that elevate our worship, even though they are forbidden, according to that, quote, higher standard, the old Jewish law. We have women on the bima, several of them singing solos in front of men, despite those laws of modesty. We have a rabbi who's gay. We have a rabbi who's a woman. And these are some of the finest Jewish leaders in the world. The clergy and the temple staff started our night tonight at about 4:30 with the Seuda Mafseket, the traditional meal of separation that we are to take to end the secular day and the start of this sacred period of Yom Kippur. We did that by eating together, coincidentally again, actually, with the meal catered by that same Syrian chef. We had our building staff, our admin team, our security personnel, all of whom are not Jewish. And it was the best way to start this day. And if it's wrong, if doing that is wrong, I don't want to be right. Because if this is what it looks like when we forget what it means to be Jewish, then I'm fine if you just call me human. So no, I am proud to report that Johanna did not stay in that service. She and her friend turned around and walked out of the room, sadly, because it was Rosh Hashanah. But before the service even began, they returned to the room for the dining hall. They returned to the space for the dinner. And they sat together to wait for the time when men and women would break bread and enter the new year in the best way possible together. Gamar Tov.